My fleeting life has come and gone.
And welcome back to the second part of this show we have today with Howard Mikowski. Did I say that name right?
Yeah, although most friends would call me Howdy, so you're welcome
Howdy.
To do that.
Yeah. And we are taking on nothing less than death. I have your book open here still, and we are basically following the table of contents and discussing around that. So that's what it's going to be about for now.
Yep. I've had my breakfast. I've had my coffee. I'm ready to go. And that would be perfect for me.
Yeah. I'd probably have my coffee as we speak, though.
Yeah. That's fine. Do what you think.
But it's so great that, yes. But it's so great that you work with, you work in a what we call småbruk, right? A small farm.
Yeah, it's a very small farm. It's just trying to grow our own grundsocker, basically.
Mm-hmm. By the way, you know Hasdal? We had a show about Hasdal, actually.
Yes.
That's where all the UFO stuff is happening, yeah.
Yep.
I think that's in Europe.
Yeah, it's not that far. That's maybe about 2.5 hours from where I live.
Huh. Nice. Well, I hope I can help you get some good income with this book. Is it out for sale yet, or are you planning to?
Oh, yeah. Oh, no, it's been out. The PDF, I think, was out in September, and then the print book came out in November. And okay. It's been good. I think I've sold 1,500 print books now, which is for a book
nice.
Like this is
yeah, nice,
wonderful.
Nice.
It's a great start.
But the one you sent me doesn't have page numbers. You may want to fix that.
Oh, I sent you one without. I do have ones. I can send you a new one with the page numbers if you'd like them.
Wait a minute. There's page numbers up to. Is it page number or is it footnotes?
Oh, it's probably. You might be seeing footnotes.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I wouldn't mind that because then I can go back and forth between the, and I can do some reading. And
yeah, so what I'll do is I'll just send you over a brand new, the newest version of it. So you've got the,
right.
Because the page numbers are supposed to be there.
Right. But do I understand it correctly that the six first chapter is one book and B is one?
No, it's, I just send that as kind of like the initial thing to reviewers, because like you say, most reviewers don't have a chance to read an entire book, and this is perfect for them to.
Right.
But no, the whole book is 240 pages.
It's not bad. People can handle that.
So
yeah.
Anyway, but I'll send that over to you so you have the whole thing and you're ready to go with page numbers and the way it's supposed to be.
Sounds good. And I promise you, our listeners, you may be right that we are a huge minority and people caring about this thing. But I've been lucky enough to find lots of people of our kin. So I think this is right up their alley, many of them, probably half of them.
One thing I found that I've been so thankful for from this is there's way more people interested in this material than I ever thought. And I get so many thanks at things because somebody's saying, finally, somebody is presenting how I've seen the world for so long, and they've kind of felt like they've had to hide from what they believe because it's different from the push that they get from everywhere else. And so I've had a lot of that of people saying, "This is nice. I've been able to hear my own thoughts presented for the first time in my life." So it's another reason I like doing these. So that there's more of us than we think. Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. I agree with that. Cool. And so for this one, you know, we have 70,000 followers on all, in total. So I think at least half of them will check this out. That's my prediction.
Great.
So we'll see. So we'll probably be able to get through chapter 4, 5, 6 then. And that's good because then we can go to part B, examination.
Yeah.
And maybe also part C before we hang up.
Perfect.
Okay. So anything more you want to deal with before we start?
No, I don't think so. You're my last interview. I'm taking a 4 to 6 week break. I'm doing a lot of inner silence work now. So
nice.
You were the last official one before I take a break. So let's do it well.
That's nice. I've just thought
thought now when we do the opening, because one of the things I have for my book is not only do I have the print book available, but I have a much cheaper PDF file. And I know, you know, a lot of people are struggling with money and there's things they like, but maybe they can't afford a whole book. This is a way they can get a cheap version. So it's also good we mention that for people that's the reason I did it, so that it's available to anybody, even if they're not swimming in cash right now. So we can find a way to throw.
Yeah,
that
they can get the cheap version. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So next chapter is called Chapter 4, Standard Near-Death Experiences. What do you convey there?
I convey these are kind of small chapters, but the point of this I wanted to make was near-death experiences are a very important piece of understanding the reincarnation trap itself, to see how were we tricked into this, what are the deceptions being used, so that we can be prepared. If we really want to go home, we have to, like you had mentioned, there are certain of things like the Apocryphon of James, the parts of the Book of the Dead. They give specific details of, in many cases, conversations you're going to have with these gatekeeper beings, and the questions they're going to ask, the answers you have to give. And so I wanted to study this. So, however, when we hear near-death experiences, 85% of them fall under a particular category, the category that the average person would, if you said, what's a near-death experience, they would say white light tunnel, beings of light, Jesus, dead grandma, death, a life review, feelings of love. These would all be what people would say. And that is 85% of the standard experience. In that standard experience, which, of course, it's a near-death experience, the person doesn't fully die, they return to this world, They tend to transform, they tend to change, they tend to become much better, much more wonderful, loving, kind people. Everything about the experience seems wonderful. I began over time researching it to see that it's highly likely a deception in itself.
Right.
That there's 15% of experiences that are not anything like that. And to me now, it's almost like the standard near-death experience is like being in the dentist waiting room, and a real death experience is actually going into the dentist chair. And a very few number of people have had that.
Right.
And those experiences, which I talk about later in the book, are really important perhaps to understanding what's really going on and what we are hearing about generally is a very light, simplified version to get people to really trust the white light tunnel, because that's the method of the reincarnation. And that's where your soul is brought into the completed cycle.
Yeah, but you don't want to create a bunch of restless ghosts roaming around either, right? And I guess that goes to the two last one called the Death Action Plan and the Recapitulation List. But I just want to say, I mean, who can blame a poor person at the deathbed when they have the fear and the darkness of being here down in the material realm, and then like in birth, it kind of opens up this, but they feel opposite of getting, being born. They feel love, attraction, and these faces that come that are familiar that they, and just logic tells you that can't be so, because they can see people are not even dead in some cases. And everybody who's religious, right? They see, oh, I see Buddha, oh, I see Jesus, oh, I see this.
Yeah.
So, there's a certain amount of projection to, but you go further. You kind of suggest that it's not just that we project onto.
No.
Right? You,
no, I think, I think it's a little different. I think it's actually these beings, what they've done is they scan, they have access to, we call them Akashic Records, right? Which is just a giant database of one's experience. They have the ability to scan this to know exactly the right deception, to know exactly the right figure, to know exactly the right presentation to put themselves in to get us to do what they want to do. Because that's a key element I found in these near-death experiences that tends to get hidden. It tends to not get noticed so much. And it's found, you'll find it in an episode of Star Trek Voyager called Coda, where the commander is dying. And in the process of dying, she's in this after-death state with what she thinks is her father, trying to get her to go into the white light tunnel and accept being dead. Eventually, she realizes it's an alien being pretending to be her father. Mm. And now the being begins to get more and more aggressive, more and more difficult. And finally, she realizes, wait a minute, you have to get me to agree to go into the tunnel. You can't force me to go.
Mm.
And that's a huge piece of what I've gleaned from the study of all of these. I've looked through hundreds, almost thousands of them now, is that there's always an element of our agreement. We still actually hold all the power, and we forget that. Even the people in the experiences forget that we have such unbelievable power, but we have been trained in life, trained in everything to give it away, to give it to another authority, to give it to a greater being, to give it to whatever spirit guides we're praying to give it whatever gods are going to give us what we think we need, when the realization is the only one we've ever need to really pray to is our true self. We have all of that power, and it's a key, I think that's a key element that I've gained from this work, is just seeing it's all a giant deception to take us away from the only one we've ever had to trust, which is ourself.
Yeah, even when they were sacrificing people, it was, you know, the victims, if you like, were primed to they wanted it. Oh, it's such an honor. Right? So it, you have it in the myth of the vampire. You're talking about sucking on energy. A vampire has to be invited in. Oh, why? Obviously, he could just, if they have these powers, right? They can just, bam, come.
Right.
No, it needs our concession. So,
right. So for me, that's a big part of this whole process, is learning to regain our own total authority and regain our own total power. And that's, you talk about these ancient traditions, and that's right in the ancient traditions themselves, is knowing where the real power lies, which is right here.
Yeah. But you mentioned that the grace could be involved in this. That's interesting, because, you know, from trips, you have the so-called machine elves, robotic creatures that are doing the nitty-gritty engineering of our incarnation. You kind of touch this.
Yeah, I've come to see it maybe a little more differently than the average person sees it. But to me, these beings, whatever we want to call them, archons or demons or whatnot, is one part of the process. There's another part of this process that is what we might call human thought forms. Whatever thought forms we've held in life generate, actually manifest in the astral realm, and those astral beings also demand energy. So there's been this battle that's been created from between the original archons of the demiurge, and then the things we've created ourselves, all battling for energy. And then we've got what I'm now beginning to, and this is something we can talk to maybe in our next broadcast, but that what we've come to see as gray aliens, or what they're called gray aliens, might in fact be human beings from the future trying to come back to this realm, hoping to in some way stop the future that created them. That literally we're on the cusp point of, if we go into the transhumanistic world, that new simulation, which would really be the new 5D new simulated reality, then the eventual evolutionary line of humans would be the gray aliens trying to figure out that this is, a few people have mentioned this, and that they're coming back trying to find ways to save their soul. So I'm just throwing all these, I mean, I can't say for sure. I don't know. I've never met one. I've never talked to one, but it's a highly plausible possibility. So we have all of these pieces, all of these possibilities that are floating out there as to trying to understand what's going on, what's going to happen when we die, and how are we the best prepared for it? And yeah, that's where a lot of these little pieces of chapter 5 and 6 come into, right? Which is some ideas of steps to start taking going forward.
Yeah, called Death Action Plan and the Recapitulation List. And I guess you just have to get his book to get his practical tools.
Well, they're very simplistic, and so they're very short chapters, so they're only taking a minute. The Death Action Plan comes from a gentleman named William Bullman, who made the idea of, if you know we're going to die, so why don't we plan out the days or weeks before our death? Why don't we have the experience the way we want it to be? The music we want, the people we want to have visiting, the affirmations we want, the images we want. And then I talk about the recapitulation in chapter 6, which is I originally found it in Carlos Castaneda's books, but it was shared with me by the number of medicine men that I was with, which is your life review, which is to go through your life in complete detail from the current moment to your birth. And originally it was presented as an idea of regaining your lost energy, or cleaning yourself, of seeing yourself clearly, which it all did. I actually did a life recapitulation. It took me 4.5 years. But I'm also seeing it's also preparation for this life review that is going to be attempted to be thrown at us in the afterlife, which is in many cases designed to bring as much guilt and shame and regret to us, i.e. karmic hooks to make us agree to come back in another body so we can learn to be more loving. But if we know, if we've reviewed our life into complete detail, that there is nothing that can, then there's nothing that can surprise us in this after-death life review, we will be, it's a way of regaining our power, not just in this world, but in the other world. So that's what those two little chapters are sharing, simply.
Because in the Greco-Egyptian tradition, they say that the judge, there's going to be a judge, and you're going to be weighed to see if you've found heavier or lighter than a feather. And the judge is yourself. So it's much better to do it before. I will say this. First, I will say that this idea you've had about the grace, believe it or not, I've had the same thought. You're the first I've met who has expressed it like that. So I find that very interesting. If several people have the same, and I mean, we're probably not alone. That alone indicates that probably others have had that thought too. And where does that come from? I think I find it interesting. But even more interesting, there's an ancient technique prescribed to a chap I mentioned before in this show called Pythagoras that is called the psychostasis. And they said he said that this is the most important spiritual discipline. You can, if you only need, if you only can work with one spiritual discipline in your life, work with this. And that is to review your, do this review daily before you fall asleep, every night, because you can do it like you did, but that's heavy work and much memories are lost. But if you do it every day, you kind of clean and reset your consciousness day by day. And he claimed, I mean, I wrote a whole article about it. If you would like, I can send it to you. I wrote it many years ago, but it's kind of the gist of this whole thing. And it's, yes, it's connected to death. And this chap who said,
of course, I love this material. I love learning about all different ways of, because there's so many ways to do life recapitulations. It's just very few people will ever choose any of them and do it.
And even when you know it, you know, the ego takes over, you get lazy. I must admit I'm not doing it every day, but I try to maintain it. This chap you said, who said, we know we're going to die, why not prepare, right? Well, that's what the ancients did. That's what's called a mystery schools. They didn't learn how to cook or whatever. It was all about death. And that's what it is about today in this show. And by the way, when you mentioned, I forgot to say this, when you mentioned these thought forms, we had a show about that too. It's, we call it egregores in some traditions. Powerful stuff, man.
Gotcha.
No, we left off at the recapitation list. Let me ask you, why are you already in the end of the A part of the book, providing, you know, the death action plan and the recapitation list? Why didn't you put it all the way at the end?
I don't understand. You mean the recapitulation list itself, or like the chapter, you mean?
Yeah, and the death action plan, because they are very practical. So I would assume that after you've entertained the different angles to death, that you end it with, look, guys, this is how you should proceed. But you put it at the end of part A.
I understand.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've decided that I thought some of the chapters are so they're so deep for people to take in, particularly those first three chapters, that I kind of felt I wanted like a little things that were a bit more slow down, things that if I gave people some things to do, they might not rush through the book as quickly as they might read it. It might kind of get them to want to think about some things or do something or just slow. It was actually, I think I put them there to slow the reader down a little bit.
Interesting. Clever device. I want to wrap up one other matter. I mentioned the gray aliens to you. But I refer to them as, you know, in the words of Val, I'll just read this. It's an excerpt from your book, but it's a quote from him. It is they, gray aliens who await in the light when a human being dies. The human being is then recycled into another body and the process begins all over again. Now, you didn't put them into that context. So let me just double check your take on those beings. We talked about them, obviously, as perhaps visitors from a dystopian future. But do you entertain his take on it?
I fully get it. It was more the I kept it in for the overall quotation itself.
Mm.
I myself, I'm not really sure what they are. So everything is still wide open. And all I can say, at least from the research, is that there are beings that will be likely interacting with us in the after death realm. Exactly what those beings are, that I can't say for sure. And of course, they're going to be so well cloaked. They're going to be so well, what's the word I'm looking for? They're going to be wearing quite a mask.
Yeah.
And so exactly what they are, I think, are less important than knowing that just there are beings and that's what we are ready to have to experience.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Totally agree. I took notice of that quote of his, and you're right, I didn't read entire quote, and the entire quote was the point in your book, as you say. But I took notice of this because it dovetails so much with descriptions of said beings in the intermediate consciousness condition. Like, you know, from my time as a meditation coach, I distinguish between the different states of brain activity. You have alpha and beta, of course, but then you have theta, which is where most of the action takes place. It's often described as between sleep and wake. And I assume most of the lucid dreamings are taking place at that level.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where you hear voices and see stuff. And I've had insane experiences, actually, in that condition, if you want. And I think it was, what's his name? Not McKenna, but one of those guys who talked about machine elves, which seem to be pretty analog to these. We're talking beings who seem like they are automation somehow. And that brings me to the idea of AI. So before we go on in your book, what thoughts do you have about that? Do you really think that they can be able, that we human beings can be able to create something that can interact with our consciousness? Obviously via the organic layers, but for example, that they somehow could plug us in and interact with Agent Smiths, if you like. Because I think that if we are in a simulation, I don't mean even not literally like a tech, like a computer, but if we are akin to something that metaphorically can be defined as a simulation.
Yeah.
Maybe then there should be a difference then if we can create something that can interact on that level, some a machine thing that can, or if Cosmos, you know, the cosmic machine we're trapped in, if that has an Agent Smith, that would be different from ours. So do you think we can contribute some artificial entity that can interact with us?
Well, I guess it's a good question. I would guess if I had to simplify my personal thoughts on it, like, you know, mm-hmm. is that our whole reality is a type of AI, that mm-hmm. the intelligence that runs the whole thing is artificial. And it's a perfect word for the way our reality is structured. So for me, the fact that there is a human created artificial intelligence within the dream is more just an example of the hermetic as above, so below, that we are just seeing, in a sense, a mirror or a copy on a smaller scale of that which is on a much bigger scale. So to me, that would be the most important work with it, would be to research backwards, in a sense, not to see where is AI going, but to see how is it a smaller copied version of the much bigger whole.
Okay, fair enough. And I really enjoy that you distinguish between your personal speculation and more matter of facts. So that's a service to the listener and the reader of your book. Very scholarly of you. Okay, so let's move on to part B of your book.
Sure.
That part is called Axiomatic. The first part, A, and we only scratched the surface, folks, so you need to get this book, but that was called Foundation. Part B is called Axiomination. You have a funny title here of chapter 7. It's Curtains for You. What would you say you take on in that chapter?
Originally, I wanted to write the book as a novel. That was my initial urge when I first sat down to write it. And this particular chapter was originally set up as the first chapter of a novel book. And I wanted to write, and I didn't want to write one novel either in sort of one style. I wanted to write using, this was the initial idea, to use different author styles for each chapter.
Nice.
So this particular chapter, because I have below it by Donnie Beige as a sneaking turn to, you know, Dan Brown. And so tried to write the chapter in that particular style. And I was going to write other chapters, be they like Michael Crichton or Robert Heinlein or all sorts of different authors to have sort of a different take on it. But after I'd done the first couple of attempts at first few chapters, I found that it was very difficult to present the material clearly. I'm not a novel writer. It's not something that comes easy for me. It was very difficult to do. And I just saw that the project would, perhaps I could complete it as an entire novel in this format, but it would be such an amount of work that I didn't think the end result would be worth it. Given that my training is as a historian, which is how to try to take chunks of research and present them quite clearly. So I made a decision to not write the book as a novel, but when I gave out some sample chapters, I just had the sample chapter just out of curiosity, the novel chapter. And what I found was so interesting was if somebody was reading, and I gave like four chapters of the manuscript to people. So if someone was very analytical, if someone was very scientific based, if someone had that kind of mindset, well, they very much liked the written chapters and they were kind of, yeah, I can see why you didn't want to write the book as a novel. I wasn't all that enthused by it. But the couple of people that I sent the same material to who were, let's say, artistic, very creative people, they loved the novel chapter. They thought it was just a wonderful way of explaining the information and they enjoyed it more than the regular stuff.
Yeah.
And so at that point, I thought maybe this is useful to keep into the book because, again, I shouldn't be placing myself into the minds of my readers and that different people have different mindsets and different things that they enjoy reading. So I cleaned it up. I tried to, you know, work in the detail, almost like putting the first six chapters into kind of like an overview in this novel chapter, I guess you would call it, and gave it there for people with this more creative mindset. I thought they would more, that they would enjoy reading the chapter, which has turned out to be true. So that's what really it's there. I don't think it's really providing too much more that I would classify as new, but it's just presenting it in a different format for those who have a different mental way of viewing research.
Yeah, and processing information. I think that's a very clever device.
Thanks.
I think it's also clever that you broke it down into timing. Dates, not dates, but timing. So that's the that's the Da Vinci Code aspect, I guess. It's good because you kind of cater to both aspects of our brain, right? So you're kind of challenging, even if it's just a chapter of the novel take, you're kind of challenging the more intellectually, I don't know the descriptions, but those who are wired more for info processing. So it's good that you have a touch of Venus to go along with Mercury. Next chapter,
given that this chapter is, I'm discussing places in Rome, so it's also, it's much easier, I think, to describe interactions with living places of power in a novel type format, in a story type format, rather than just standard research on a page of information. I think there's, because it is an interaction, it is an experience. So I hope that because I'm writing about locations and the characters experiencing the location, that it has value then in a story format.
Yeah, and that's a callback to what you said in part one about, you know, some sacred sites. You just have to experience them. You can't just see. You know, it's a method that was used very much in antiquity, and people project back in time, right? So we're using our contemporary mindset to understand the past, which is a huge mistake. And in the past, especially in ancient times, the storytelling was an important tool to convey truth. There can be more truth in a novel than in a piece of factual writing. What's the opposite of novel again? Prose, I guess. Donny Besh, that's your nom de plume?
That was, yeah, that's, because I didn't want to actually use the actual real author's name, because, you know, who knows, with someone would be offended in his publishing firm.
All right, right.
So,
right.
So I tried, to, I was going to, I had, like I say, I had one done up for one little name for all of the authors I was going to use. And I wasn't going to mention that I was doing that in the novel. I would see if anybody who would read it would figure out that that's what I was doing, because they should have noticed that each chapter would have been written very differently.
Right, right. Well, next chapter is called, I love this title, They Live in a Dark City, Lost with Their Eyes Wide Shut. I count four references to famous movies there. They Live.
Yeah, and there was more, but I couldn't get them in the title.
But this is clever, because some movies, back to the storytelling, do usually intentionally, but even inadvertently, do take on some of these major topics that goes back to Plato and even before. And we've already, of course, discussed Matrix and Dark City. But what is the purpose of this chapter?
For me, it was, again, this idea of taking, you know, there will be some people who are reading, who come to a book like mine and are well-versed in this material. They've done work for 10 or 15 years and thought deeply and philosophical and intense exercises on themselves. But I know there'll be people that this material is quite new to. And one of the ways I think of accessing or helping material that is very deep is to, yeah, like you say, can you find stories that that people can relate to? Now, if this was 30, 40 years ago, when everybody still took Greek and Roman mythology in school, well, you could have gone into depth in Greek or Roman myths, and the average person would have some background in it because it was part of the schooling. Like you say, technically now, the current mode of mythology is movies.
Yeah.
And some television shows. Mm. And so I thought this was more of a way of potentially connecting to that story memory of a person's mind. And of course, there's a number of movies that I could have chosen from. I made a choice of, I think, about five or six that I went through. And a combination of this chapter and the rest of it is in the appendix. I kind of just... Originally, the chapter was, I don't know, 40 pages or something, and I needed to just split it down so it didn't get too long. But the hope was then is somebody could then be interested. They've either seen these movies or they want to see some of these movies, and then they can try to apply potentially this new way of thinking or this new thesis and watch it being presented in story form via a movie. And I thought this would be a valuable way of sharing information. And then it becomes something that it's easier to share with someone else. I think if you want to try to share an idea just as a concept with a person, that's hard. But if you can share a concept with the television show Westworld or the TV show Lost or They Live or Stanley Kubrick movie or something that a friend of yours has also seen, you can talk about concepts on a deeper level, because you're sharing in a sense a shared mythology, a shared story. And that allows the possibility of very deep communication. I did one of the movies I mentioned in Falling for Truth, one of my other earlier books, was the movie Pleasantville from 19, it was around 1998, 99, same time as The Matrix and Dark City. And what I'd one time I'd had a small group.
So many movies. Yes, sorry, so many movies came at that time with a similar kind of, and it must be the zeitgeist. I don't know what it was.
Yeah, I don't know either, but there was something happening, with a whole bunch of information coming out in those few years. And what I did was I had a small group at that time that was, most of us still living in Canada. And we got together and we watched Pleasantville. None of them had ever seen it. So we put it on for them and they watched it. And we decided to have a discussion when it was done. The discussion lasted for almost 4 hours. Just on the movie. There were so many little pieces of information that one person would see and the rest wouldn't see. And then it moved into such an unbelievable discussion. And that's kind of where I realized where the movie has a great value is not so much me or you watching it alone in our house. It's watching it with 10 or 15 like-minded people. And then having all of them share their ideas and thoughts and viewpoints and things they picked up from it. And that was one of the most enjoyable nights I ever had in my life, was all of the insights that came up from people from that movie. And so I guess that's where I wanted to keep discussing movies and TV going through it with my books, because I saw the value it had in that one night experience with this group of people.
Very important tool for cultivation. You know, there's like four ways to approach, I should say, wisdom emerging, and the colloquial, which is extrovert and collective. You have extrovert individual, you have extrovert collective, you have introvert individual, and you have introvert collective. That's the four tools to cultivate growth in mind. And the living word has to be experienced. It was a main tool in ancient days, almost lost today, but that's what you replicated there and then. You know, if it was in ancient time, it would be maybe a lecture or storytelling or something. And then when everyone is, you know, already they are like-minded to a certain degree, so they can more or less vibrate on the same frequency. And then they put that together. And when I've done that, like I was the teacher, so to speak, the guide, whatever. So I knew the material already, and the novices were gathered around. I had already certain main points I wanted to convey because they're important. But what I discovered was if it was one-to-one, it would be different. But when we were a group, what happened was that one person touched one Erkennelse, as we say, Erkenntnung in German, I guess you could say realization in English, that triggered another realization. And so it was very dynamic. And by the end of it, I didn't get to say anything because they have all addressed the main points, which were suggested. They weren't overt. So yeah, it's a very great tool to put minds together and lift collectively. It really works. So interesting you had that experience. As for this chapter, when you, it's interesting device again that you go from a novel to a novel review, kind of, because a film critic maybe, but on a deep, a philosophical approach. So first you give them Venus, the novel, then you give them Mercury, where you're still kind of in a novel landscape, right? But now you're breaking down not the chapter that you presented, but other similar ways of, and you mentioned some. I'd like to give a shout out to Adjustment Bureau, because that has gone under the radar for so many people.
Yeah.
You do mention it. It's one of the great ones.
Yeah.
I think you also mentioned Westworld.
Yeah. I have to flip through the book myself, I have to remember. But yeah, Dark City first. I didn't really speak. I speak a bit about The Matrix in relation to Dark City, but
right.
I don't really go into it because too many people have seen it. Too many people have talked about it. So this was about other things. Yeah. Then I did Westworld. Then there was Inception that I talked a bit about. I talked about They Live, the Roddy Piper classic movie, a small bit about Donnie Darko, at the Adjustment Bureau, the television show Lost, which I thought had a lot of possibility. And then I was going to end originally with a lot of Stanley Kubrick material, but I shortened it down to just looking at the first, I looked at the first 10 minutes of the movie, Eyes Wide Shut, only the first 10 minutes, just to show people how many things you probably missed just in that first 10 minutes as an idea. Go back and watch the rest of the movies that he's done in this kind of fashion. And then I did a little bit on 2001, A Space Odyssey, a small bit because it does relate to questions of what we're dealing with. And I finished with a small segment on the Star Trek Voyager episode Coda. So those are the things that the combination of the chapter and the appendix in the back deal with. Those are the ones I chose. And I've, like, you know, like you say, I could have chosen 20 more, but eventually you get a time frame and you have to move on to something else.
You do mention others, though. Mention Truman Show is mentioned. One I wonder if you have seen, which would be it's been deconstructed many times, but it should be deconstructed with a mind like yours. And that's The Prisoner, that old classical TV series. Have you seen that?
Oh, from the 60s.
Yeah,
from the 1960s. It's very interesting. And it's so, like you say, it's so subtle because there are a lot of the stuff in The Prisoner is it's not in your face. It's always kind of in the background. It's subtly mentioned. There's very little of it placed right in front of you. And it does require a very, you have to be in a very clear state of mind to watch The Prisoner, actually. You can't try to rush your way through that. You need awareness to watch it. Yeah. Mm.
I've had two shows on it, and my interview objects, they weren't that spiritually polarized. So we hashed out a lot of the political levels, the psychological levels. But, you know, the creator, he was schooled classically. He said himself that some of it was inspired by so-called mystery plays from antiquity, you know, the mystery dramas. I'm not sure what the English terminology is, but it's a way where you display myths to educate people. And I just to illustrate your point, and then we'll move on, just one very subtle thing in that series is that you remember Rover, these weird balloons?
They
could go underwater. They hovered in air, and they were a control mechanism. Never in the series were they explained. They were just matter of fact there. And they had a spooky sound. I see that as a parallel to UFOs, because back then, not now anymore, but back then, it was the same thing. It's here. It has, everybody knows about them, but nobody's discussing them. I mean, in the public Overton window, it's left to the shadows, right? So it's interesting. So that's just one of many, many. But and of course AI and everything, they were so before its time. That's the thing with The Prisoner, that, okay, you may watch it now and, oh, I've seen it all before. Yeah, you've seen it in 100 other later creational works, but this was the groundbreaking part.
I'll give everybody, I guarantee, here's one you've probably never seen before. Mm-hmm. I found it about a year ago, bumped into an act, another BBC program, but it was a half hour, one of their half hour theater productions, 1968. It's called The Newsbenders.
Oh, never heard of
it. No, it literally describes our entire reality. Not only does it do that, it was laying out that it was the news media who were not just falsifying news, that they weren't just taking news, they were manufacturing the news. They were showing, they've got the moon landing already that they're gonna do, they've got this rocket launch, they've got, and literally they were indicating that everything was being actually created. And eventually created by it was a computer. It was an AI device running the whole news department. Honestly, it's It's the one of the most mind-blowing pieces of information of like, how did they let this get on the air?
Yeah.
And how did nobody hear about this until like a couple of years ago? I've got a couple of videos on my channel, but you don't need to go. You can, if you just Google searched or went into, you know, YouTube or something, just Newsbenders 1968, the 30-minute video will come up. Highly recommend that you will just by the end of that go, how did that get on television?
I'm guessing it's because, and I don't know if this is true, you confirm or deny, but because they cloaked it, they presented it in a science fiction outlet. That was like that was the genre.
Well, it was called 30 Minute Theater, I think was the name of the program. And it was like, back then they had, like Twilight Zone, type shows, but this wasn't a sci-fi. This was just theater production. So this was just 30 minute, different kinds of theater. Now, of course, people would have been used to, a more sci-fi type of story. So it would have been fine to have it in, but that wasn't the nature of the program itself. It was just small stage theater productions in a sense, put on television. What's really interesting is when I won't get on this too long, people can look into it themselves. But when I started looking into like, well, I wanted to know who the writer of this was. And when you go look for the writer, it's kind of like the writer almost like doesn't exist. It's like they wrote this and then they were just, working on the back set after this. The director has a very strange background to him. Donald Pleasance is the main character who stars in this. And of course, we know Donald Pleasance was involved in a series of unique movies in the 1960s. And so everything about it, once you try to study it, was also very strange. So I'm just going to leave it there. We'll move on with other things, but I highly recommend people go look at this 30 minute BBC production, because it'll blow your mind.
Yeah. No, they did get away with more back then. It was in the middle of this consciousness shift in 68. So I'm not surprised they could sneak something like that in there.
Yeah.
As for these narratives that present truths in metaphors, or maybe not even metaphors in this case, you do mention the Castaneda in the book, and that's akin to, these movies. There was, I guess that book goes back to the 60s too, doesn't it? There was a lot of books back then that, I remember Elisabeth Heisch, she had Initiation. I guess that book goes back to the 50s. There was a lot of books that came out that used the fiction outlet to convey eternal truths. I mean, there's too many to really list. But today, like you say, it's movies. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So next, chapter 9 is non-standard near-death experience. Now, you did touch this in part 1, but did you ever cover how many percent, I think you did mention it, that were the standard, love and light, and how many deviates in percentage?
Yeah, I gave a rough estimate. I thought it was about 85 to 15. I thought that was kind of like a fair estimate. But of course...
And this is taking on the 15, right?
Yeah, this one's taking on the 15%. And generally the 15% always gets ignored, which is very interesting. It doesn't matter who's doing what the researcher is. That 85% gets all the focus. There might be, if they write a book or something, they might put a page on something, but on these other ones, they gloss over it. And to me, that's the most interesting question of all, is if you're a researcher, why aren't you examining all of them, even the ones that aren't in the main category? The question becomes, why do they want to ignore them? Why do they want to not put attention on them? And I think we know the answer, but that was the first part I found interesting.
Yeah, but I think there's also a non-sinister answer, because if you're an academic, a scholar, and you are a scientist, actually, and you want to find what applies to all, what we in Norwegian call allmenngyldig, I guess you could say objective in English, it will be interesting to filter out subjective stuff, projections, what archetypes have been activated in my mind. it has less value than which are over. So you see over time and over cultures and over religions, you do start to see common denominators. And if you're focused on that, yeah, the baby can go out with the bathwater, because you may lose some very interesting, like Ruth talks about the moon, which we have already touched, that role. And she says something very interesting that goes to these machine elves again, or the Greys, or the Agent Smiths. And that's that she's trapped in this reincarnation cycle. And that, well, I think she says helping souls to reincarnate, but you say they are in charge of reincarnation. So you have some kind of entities that are guiding or controlling, you pick your poison here, your angle, that process we're trapped in. And that goes back to the great avatars of humanity.
Yeah.
They all have a message in common, whether it's Pythagoras or Buddha or Jesus or whatever. They all talk about how we have to liberate ourselves from the cycles, from the wheel. Even in Christianity, you can make an argument for that. Not just counting now the early Christianity, which had a reincarnation implicit.
Yeah.
So it wasn't a big deal until it got purged much, much, much later. But even in the purged version, the whole point of getting to heaven is not necessarily as an opposition only to one life. I mean, even if you entertain the notion of hell, they're already emitting different types of consciousness states. But you're saying, like, the big deal is to liberate yourself so you get past the reincarnation wheel, namely nirvana or heaven.
Right.
Or, like the ancient Greeks said, to go back to the sun. In other words, you have to liberate yourself from the limitations of Earth and the moon, which are triggers in the reincarnation cycle. Now, I know, I noticed, and I did intend to discuss it with you, maybe not here, but I'll leave it to you. We could return to it. You kind of seem to demonize the sun. You kind of seem to think the sun is like a bad part of this, potentially. You're not making any definite statements. But
no,
to me, in my view, from everything I've seen in this, it seems that the sun is the goal, but we kind of refrained from actually getting from the moon to the sun, but we're thrown back to the earth again in this never-ending energy cycle. So any comments to this part of, we shouldn't dwell too long on this chapter, but I think it's a very crucial point.
Yeah, we can get to the sun stuff when we get to chapter 13, because that's where I discuss it there.
Let's do that. Yeah.
If I would use a word, because I know you used the word liberate, which is a word that's used quite often. But if I was going to use a word now, I would use the word remembering. That the most important element is, and there's so many different metaphorical associations with that word, but to me, that's what, it's less of a liberation, it's more of a remembering. And that's what the work really is.
Yeah. Reminds me of Gurdjieff, who used, that was the main part of his recipe to get out of here. That was to always remember yourself. I really recommend people reading. I mean, this is, talk about the fiction narrative, or I should say the novel narrative. Reading these stories, these experiences, is as interesting for people who approach this with a novel preference. Because here you get only these... These stories are true in the sense of people have experienced it, but it's really informing. It's really exciting, thrilling, I'd say, to read this and meditate over some.
Yeah, and every one of the ones I've chosen, they all come from the site Near Death Experience or NDERF.org, and I give the person's name and the number because I've only taken a piece of their story.
Yeah.
Right. Their story might be 7 or 8 pages long. And of course, I just took out a piece with the idea that if you should go and read some of these in detail, because actually some of the complete story that they give is what's amazing. The tiny piece I share in the book is just like a pointer to go see all of their experience. So if anything, that's kind of what that chapter was meant to do, was to get people to go and look into these kinds of stories, are these kinds of experiences, in a little more depth.
Yeah. And this site, NDERF, is that the one? Or yeah, that's Jeffrey Long. He's a well-known researcher in this field.
Yeah.
So they are these are vetted experiences, right?
I think most of them are. Most of them are people sharing it, but there's some sort of quality control, you might say. I know there are ones that are put up by this. It's called the Near Death Experience Research Foundation. Yeah, I think is the specific name of the site. And some of them they've brought forth from books and stories and research, and others are just, yes, people that have put them up themselves. So more than that, of like exactly who's behind it and whatnot, I'm not sure, other than I know that it's a very nice resource center. And so it's one of the ones I just remind people about.
Yeah, they have one there called Exceptional NDAs. NDEs. I think I'll start there. Your next chapter is called Prayer. What would you like to share about that?
Well, I guess I'll tell the main story of the chapter for everyone, because I think it's valuable. It's a very small little chapter, and if you hear now what I'm going to say, you probably won't have to read it now after this, so you get a kind of like get a freebie out of this. But it was started as I began the process of really contemplating this idea of prayer in a much more deeper way about a year ago when I began working on this book. Even though I'd spent a lot of time, like I mentioned, with the Native medicine men, learned how they pray, which is a type of thank you as opposed to wanting something. And I thought I understood their level of prayer. I realized that I didn't. But I began thinking, why do we constantly pray to something outside of ourselves? Why are we constantly asking some spirit, some animal, some god,
Ancestor.
some whatever, something outside of ourselves? Please, please, please give me this, you know. Why don't we just go within and pray to ourself? And I put this to a medicine man friend over the summer, Jerry, and I told him that, and he said, well, I have a story for you. He said a number of years ago there was a drought that happened in Arizona or North or New Mexico or something, and it had gone on weeks and it hadn't rained, and so they brought some local medicine men in. They prayed for rain and nothing happened, so they went and got a different medicine man from up north, and he came down, he did his ceremony, and it rained that night. And then they asked him afterwards, they asked him, why did your ceremony work when all the other medicine men's ceremonies didn't? And he said, oh, the other medicine men were praying for rain. I just prayed rain. When you pray for something, it means it's not here. So I put that back to Jerry. I said, so what he did is he first became rain. So then it was rain praying to rain, not medicine man praying to rain. So the only thing that existed had to be rain. So of course, what had to manifest was rain. And Jerry said, yeah, now you got it. And that next day, because it was blueberry picking season, and I was out doing my normal picking of blueberries. And of course, before I would go out, I would always leave an offering to the forest and the berries and say thank you and thank you to to nature. But this time I said, okay, I'm gonna become a blueberry. So I spent about 15 minutes just being very, very still and getting the sense of, well, what does a blueberry feel like? How does a blueberry experience the world? How does a blueberry think? And when I finally felt I was a blueberry, that's when I made my prayer of thanks to the other blueberries. When we went out to pick the berries after that, there were more berries than could have possibly been picked in weeks. It was just, they were everywhere. And it was like I realized this is one of these very simple techniques, which is you can't pray first. You'll never be successful with prayer until you become first that which you pray for. And it's like, why wasn't I ever taught this in all these years of all the different places I've gone to? This is the great secret. So the point of the chapter is another idea of the power is within, the power is not on something external to us.
Yeah, and you used identification too. The prayer becomes more of an invocation than a request with this approach. I want to substantiate your realization because it's also everybody has heard about The Secret, which is was a fad in New Age milieus some decades back. Now, they never hid the fact that it is extracted from esoteric sources. It's a leak, actually, from esoteric sources. And the problem with the secret, to start there, is that it's not the only law in the universe. So when people were like absorbed into that, oh, why can't I become the king of the world? Well, there are other laws that may mitigate this law. So you have to work through all the nature laws if you're going to focus on one and get that to work. But yeah, a great secret in manifestation. This, you find it in magic. You find it in, like, the Rosicrucians has this as one of their top secrets when it comes to visualization, is that, yeah, what you need to do, you need to put it through a four-step process. But the last process is the affirmation. It's like, it's not may it become. It is rather, it is like this. So it's a confirmation. It is, it's sic fiat in Latin.
Yeah.
So it's hard to explain. So instead of saying, may this happen, I want this to happen. Like, for example, if I'm visualizing a new place to live, I'm not going to visualize that I am granted that, but that I'm already living in that place, if you see what I mean. This is very similar, if not identical, to the principle you just flushed out. So see, now they got more freebies here.
Super.
This is straight from the Rosicrucian sources. I've read their high degree material. I'm a collector of occult documents, so I confirm this.
Okay.
So yeah, it's an important principle. It's already like this. And yeah, identify. So when you visualize it, like Howdy just said, feel it with all your senses as it's alive around you. You can smell it. You can touch it. So it's not just visualization with vision. Use all your senses.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Anything to add, or should we move on?
I think we're good.
Yeah. So next chapter then is spiritual warfare. Now that can go many ways. What do you mean with that term?
Yeah, it was just a nice title, I think, because I had done some videos with those titles before, so I thought I would keep it. It's a combination of asking some questions about getting people to really dig into the idea of what is this idea of good and evil. So what is really duality? Because spiritual warfare is always presented as a good versus evil thing. So, okay, what actually is that? We can see it from the standpoint, let's say, of manifestation, but what does that actually mean? And then, of course, usually the idea presented is that, well, if just we come love, then this will solve all of our problems. And it becomes a bit of a discussion of asking, well, what even is that word, and of what value is that? So that's a short overview. Is the chapter is meant to ask these questions of, yeah, what is this seemingly dual forces, not just of good and evil, but all dual forces that we notice in reality, and what are we going to do with our interaction with them? That's if I could simplify the chapter.
But what do you refer to as the great secret in that chapter?
The great secret for me was this idea of, again, this idea of love being, people, because that's part of the after death, I call it type of drug experience, which is giving the after death soul consciousness so much love that they're just bombarded with it, that they're almost in a drugged out state, that they're not able to think with any kind of logic. They're not able to truly make any clear, deep decisions with what the Greeks would call nous, right? With that deeper mind. And then that gets brought back as being, because it feels so wonderful, that should be the answer to everything. And to me, the what I called the great secret, I guess, if you wanted to put it that way, was this idea that, how to say it, that when the ancients would speak about love, it had nothing to do with anything in the material. It had nothing to do with anything of a physical body. It had nothing to do with a feeling. It had nothing to do with a possession. It had nothing to do with anything material, or even in these astral realms. It was a state of, they use it as a sort of state of being within that which is outside of the matrix, that which is outside of the cave. and the standard way that this, that we have come to focus on this word or this feeling is another way of drawing us into the matrix, trapping us in matter. And in fact, will trap us in the reincarnation cycle, because if we are so attached to this feeling of wanting to feel love, then all they have to do is these beings is throw something that we love greatly in front of us in the after death state. And most will just go immediately towards it like a magnet, as opposed to if we are attracted to true love, which has nothing to do with an object, which has to do with absolute totality, you might say, or some type of complete oneness and complete unity, the complete, the totality of everything, then all of these, what you might call minor states almost, will be able to be turned away from as we keep our attention focused on the one thing that's important, which is the totality. So I guess that's what I was trying to, that's what I'm trying to present in this chapter. I don't know how well I'm saying it here to you right now, but that's kind of the message, is to even make sure you're examining what is presented as the greatest feeling you can possibly have, and say, okay, that's still an emotion, that's still energy. Where does that energy go? What happens to it? Just because it feels good for me doesn't necessarily mean it's good for the goal of regaining my totality of self, you might say. So that's what that chapter is about. It's getting someone to ask these questions as they go along.
Next chapter is short and sweet, and here we come to lucid dreaming, a topic we've discussed in several shows on our show, and it starts with a very apt quotation of Poe: "All that we see or seem is but a dream within a dream." Now, it's very short. What's your message here? Do you consider lucid dreaming as a viable tool?
I considered it as a possible option for people, along with out-of-body experiences, and only from the standpoint of, as you know, I've worked with a lot of exercises. I'm actually in the process of putting a little book together for hopefully in the summer to talk about different exercises without drugs is kind of going to be the focus of the book.
Oh, man, I'll have you back when that book is out. Yeah, go on.
Yeah. But for some people, who have not had that experience of being in a bodiless state, who have not had the experience of being consciously aware and not having a physical body at the same time, because that will be the after death state. The after death state will be, you know, the body won't be there, but there will be an awareness. So for me, these exercises can be helpful, mostly just to get somebody used to the possibility that you can be in your mode of awareness or your mode of observation, and not be dealing with material senses, that you're dealing with different senses and different awareness. So for me, that's not that it's going to take anyone necessarily to any kind of great knowledge. I mean, I got useful things when I did my lucid dreaming exercises and the out-of-body experiences I had, but it's, to me, I think it's more just if and when the death experience comes and all of a sudden, hey, we're not in a body anymore, it's not instantly confusing. We've had these experiences of it prior to it, so hopefully we can a person can move, or the soul can move into that experience a little easier. And because, again, I think the more, it seems like anyway, from looking into these near-death experiences, the more confused someone is at the beginning state of it, the easier they seem to be able to be manipulated. And the more that when I read them, that somebody seems to be quite clear, quite aware, they know what's happened, they know, they have a pretty good idea where they are, and they're already trying to make decisions, the manipulation is much more difficult on them. So that was, even though it's like three pages, that's the message, I guess, that's coming from that chapter.
Yeah. But wouldn't you say that the same is possible with, for example, because when you are in a lucid dream, you certainly realize that stuff like colors are not actually determined by the material impulses. Obviously, right, there's no immaterial impulses, but you still see colors. But wouldn't you say that experiences like LSD or magic mushrooms can also gain that realization of that train you to feel without being identified with the body?
Of course, that's you know, there's a reason. Like I say, I'm going to be writing a book all about how to alter consciousness without drugs. But the drugs do provide something. There is information in doorways that they do present, and that is one of them that you can get from them. The problem is always that, as anyone who's taken drugs for quite a while will always let you know, the drug gives you something, but the drug demands something in return. And often people don't realize what, you might say, the drug is demanding from them until it's quite deep in the process, and they've paid quite a toll for what they've got. So for me, it's finding ways to be able to do this with, again, where it's all reliant on your own energy, on your own awareness, on your own exercises. As you well know, to learn how to do these exercises are not necessarily difficult, but they do require time and effort and work. And the other way is much easier. You get into it much easier, but then you've lost the control. You've lost, and again, you're giving up these things. So for me, I was always lucky that at the beginning, when I started this journey, I had teachers who were very clear on learn to do these practices via exercises, and then you'll be able to do them safely anytime you want for the rest of your life, and you'll be able to teach them to anyone anytime in your life safely. And I've kind of kept to that standpoint from my own, from how I feel about things.
Amen to that. So now we come to the end of part B, but we've actually already reached the top of the hour. If you don't have the time to go through the entire book today, by the way, we'll just stop where it naturally stops, and people will have to read it to get the rest. But we come to an important chapter. Yeah, you want to say something?
Yeah, I'm good, actually. I'm fine for now, so I'm good.
Okay.
Yeah, we're pretty good. We've got like another good 15 minutes here or so. So we're good for that. If you need to, but I'm fine.
No, I'm fine too. Okay.
Yeah, we're good.
So this, the title is I'm a Soul Man. Now, I did think in part one, at some point, if context permitted it, and it does here, to raise the question of how you got soul out of soul. Because from the terminology I've seen, it comes from water, actually, which makes perfect sense, because in many ways, you can describe the souls as the ocean. Then the clouds extract water up and flushes it down as rain. Now, that could be the reincarnation process. And the interesting thing is that we keep our distinct, the water droplets keep their distinct, they do not get erased. It can happen that at the molecular level,
right,
water droplets can be restructured, just as I'm betting the same can be with souls. But in actual fact, most often they do survive that process. But I see you are aware of this etymology. And then I realize, okay, you've gone one step deeper since you connected to soul. So my first question from this chapter is just how do you see a connection to, because that's super interesting, to the sun with the soul?
Yeah, it was obviously something, like you said, when I'm talking about soul, eventually it came to the point of, well, what does that even mean? What do you actually, it's so many times that it used to bother me back in the, you know, at the beginning of a spiritual journey, you're always, the spiritual books are always talking about the ego, you know, the ego's bad, but no one ever defines it. No one ever told you what is an ego. They just talk about how bad it is and what you have to do about it. But so I knew I had to get to soul eventually. And I looked into all the different possibilities. Like you say, there was the Germanic Norse word that's related to a lake as a possibility. There was ones that were similar to the words for salvation. But for me, I kind of locked into this idea with the sun, because in so many Western languages, the word for the sun is pronounced exactly the same, soul. And it's written just without the U in it. Soul is soul. And once we start seeing, we have a solar system, we have solar plexus, and I began to get this sense of, because there's many near-death experiences that relate to when they are going to the light. They often say the light is the light of the sun, that the white light tunnel they are going towards is the sun. That's what's drawn. Some, of course, say the moon, but some say it's the sun. And so that was my initial and then I go into other words of the idea of hell, and it's where that word comes from, because that, of course, has a Germanic Norse origin that has nothing to do with what the word.
We have places.
Yeah,
we have places in Norway called hell.
Right, because it has a very different meaning than the way that word has come to mean in our world. Yeah. But that word has become Helios. Helios is, has a connection to Helios, and Helios is also the sun. So we have these very strange interactions with that word. And so the chapter is kind of just, it's not like I'm giving any answers, but I'm trying to share these possibilities of the words could link to this, could link to that, could link to a number of different things. Again, it's more, I'm not certainly trying to give an answer, like what is the dark night of the soul? What does that really mean? And trying to find how many places this word soul shows up in our language. It's in more places than anyone realizes, from, soulmates to, I've lost a part of my soul, or they've got heart and soul, or this person's going to save my soul. This is, the word is just used. I won't tell a soul. We have a soldier, soul dear, soul doer, soul dire. So we have all of these, the word just is popping all through our English language anyway. It's popping all through the language. And I wanted to just let people know how odd, in a sense, the word is from the standpoint of its connective usages, as a way of, like anything, getting maybe those who are really interested in the study of language to, maybe that's something they want to pull apart further, to look deeper into the word and the origin and how it's used, not just in the English language, but in various other similar sounding, Western Germanic languages.
Yeah. I want to reveal as a bonus to those who have kept attention to this entire show today and made it to the middle of part two, that the ancient Greek mystery cults, one of their great secrets, and I allegedly goes back to Egypt, was that we have three deaths. The first death is the death of soma, where part of your being goes back to earth. Obviously, that's from earth. They erratically say, did you come? But it's your body. And to earth it returns. The second death was the psyche, which, I prefer to, like you do, it's so important what you do. You examine these mainstream terms that are thrown around, because they are meaningless at the end of the day if you don't try to get to the root of what they actually refer to get a proper understanding. In fact, when you do that in different traditions, you'll see nobody agrees about the soul and the ego. There are better terms for this. It's like God, right? God is a word everybody knows and uses, but there are as many understanding of it as there are minds to process that idea. And I think the same is true for the soul. So it becomes a useless term. I'm not saying it's not a true term, but it becomes a useless term. But you have the second death, which is psyche, which could be part of your soul, the way many people uses it. And that's where the moon comes in. I could go in much more details than I do now, but we don't have the time. The third death is then the nous, which is supposed to return to the sun. And that is, for them, the big achievement. But the problem was that there is something stopping us from this reuniting with our source. There is something that keeps us in this endless loop, feedback loop, if you like, the reincarnation trap of the Buddhists. And so, to me, I have always seen it then as, because there can be no denying that you live here now, you know this feeling when the death part of the year is over, when winter has retreated and we approach spring equinox. Now, sometimes spring becomes comes before equinox, like we talked about before we started recording the second part here. And sometimes it comes after, but it's that feeling of, oh my God, where have you been, Father, Son? There's a reason I think people were worshiping the sun. It's this feeling of, oh, life, I can breathe again, warm, light. I don't blame anyone from associating these things to the positive. But you do question if that is just a programming, a habit, maybe, I don't know. Because you don't seem to automatically buy into that sun is our salvation, that is our great liberator.
No, one thing I guess I've come to see at least is whatever tends to be, particularly in spiritual matters, whatever tends to be the most presented or the on the side of the highest percentage of the way things are presented, that's usually false. That truth is usually on the side that doesn't get presented. So not that I say yes or no to anything, but anything that seems to be, this is what 80% of this, just like the near-death experience, whatever 80 or 85% is of this material presents, I tend to instantly think, well, that's probably false. So I want to look at the other 15% that would say the opposite, because I think there's a high likelihood of truth in that side. So I guess I just, from my own experience now, just whatever's in the majority, that's the word I'm looking for, whatever the majority is presenting, I tend to look to the minority first and see if I can find truth in the minority. And if I can't find any possible truth in the minority, then I'll say, okay, maybe the majority got this one right. So that's kind of how I proceed with almost anything I find now.
Healthy attitude, I think. But, you know, the sun isn't exactly, I mean, the sun has never been more demonized than in our time and age. That's a telltale sign for me. Oh, you have to protect yourself with sun blocker. That's, finally, they realize that's how you get cancer. Skin cancer, that enhances skin cancer. Oh, don't look into the sun. You're in a pupil in a school. Oh, put the curtains down so we don't get the sun on us. I've always regarded these as crazy.
Well, here's an interesting thing for people to think about, and then we can kind of maybe move on to another topic. But just for fun, ask yourself what really powers the sun. Where does that energy really come from? We're told scientifically what makes the heat. What if, and this is just a what if for fun, what if the sun is really the last destination for souls? It is the place where the soul is, in a sense, burnt up, where what we have come to know as a hell takes place. All of the energy is eaten by these beings and it gets recycled. And then that energy, some of it, is put into what we call the physical manifestation of the sun and is projected back to us. And that the energy we're actually taking in from the sun, as important as it is for our material life, is really the souls of all of those who have passed before us. Wouldn't that be quite the deception?
Yes. And the whole physical universe would be a gigantic prison, because there are other suns out there which are consuming the beings in their solar systems. But
again, I'm not saying that's true. No. Just saying it's another interesting thing to contemplate that normally a person would never think of. Yeah. I never thought of it until I wrote the book.
No, I encountered similar ideas, at least. But it's absolutely something to consider. But you could also twist it. You could also say that, there are some indications that it may be, at least we know that quasars are, or so-called white holes, are expressions from the, what do they call it? The, where Star Trek spaceships run, what's it called? The hyperspace, maybe?
Oh, I see, yeah.
And that black holes are entrances into these other dimensions. So I do look at fire even as a potential hole in the dimension. This is like a completely metaphysical approach, but it's, science doesn't know. Science knows what needs for fire to manifest, so they can describe the actual process, but it is still a mystery. And akin to that, we have the fire in our being, making sure of the temperature. Just think of this. You can survive 4 weeks without food in general. You can survive 4 days without water in general. You can survive 4 minutes without air in general, but only 4 seconds without fire. And yeah, of course, that means temperature. Let's say you were flushed out in outer space, for example. In 4 seconds, bam, the temperature change is too big. So this temperate thing that keeps us going, warms us from within, etc., we have a fire in us. And if we are off the fire, then the question you raise is it good or bad to be reunited with that source? I think no one can give the final answer to that, but it's worth thinking of.
Okay.
When it comes to one more thing in this chapter, we'll move on, ghosts, you say.
Yeah.
Now, ghosts is interesting because I've always tended to look at apparitions as soulless. But in the ancient, so you touch it yourself. Like if you get a huge trauma, it's like an astral explosion. It's like you're infesting the atmosphere, that area you're in, with that pain, with that psychic energy. Mm. So the soul may be gone, but the shell, the echo of the experience may repeat itself for some time before it's dissolved. But then I got the idea from the Plutarch and those guys who revealed what I said in terms of the moon and the earth and the sun, is that some may not even re-experience the second death. If they're really earthbound, if they're really attracted to this level for some reason, whether it's greed, desire, pain, yearning, you name it, right? There can be many motivations. Mm. Maybe, just maybe, the soul can be attached and then they become wanderless souls because they don't even have that. They're not even reincarnating because they're not being thrown to the moon. Any thoughts about this?
Actually, I think that's a pretty good overview. I see kind of something fairly similar, that it's a really good example that they can't even move forward to reincarnate because they're so attached to something in the material. I assume if you saw, I mean, we talk about trauma usually, but I think a few ghosts can become ghosts because there's something that they love something so much that they can't bear to leave it. You know, maybe there was a tree or a lake or something experience. And so it's something, it seems like, anyway, to me, it's something material that has like a really good hold on that soul. And so they don't go forward. Now, what's interesting to me now is when we used to watch stories, remember, we used to see stories, things on TV about ghosts, and the psychic would come to the house and tell the ghost, oh, you need to go to the white light. You need to, it's time for you to move on. And of course, I'm thinking now, if I was in the room with a ghost, is that what I would tell the ghost, to go to the white light?
Mm.
Probably not. Mm. I would want to tell the ghost, hey, I think you're attached to the material, and that's not really a good thing for your energy. You probably see a white light. My suggestion is don't go there either. Maybe you want to explore this other realm a little bit deeper. Let go of the material, but don't go to the light either. And maybe that's the best way to help the soul, because I don't know necessarily now, saying go to the white light, which means probably guaranteed you're reincarnating. And now this soul that's probably already traumatized is just coming back into another round of trauma. So it even opens up another question of what would be the truly best kind gift to give to a ghost, because obviously you don't want the ghost still stuck here in the material. I don't want to necessarily automatically just send it to the white light. So what's the third option? And I don't know yet. And maybe the listeners who are hearing this, and for some of you who maybe partake in this possibilities, you maybe you'll come up with the third suggestion of this is maybe the kindest thing to do for a soul that is in a ghost form.
No, it makes sense that if it's traumatized, it should, if possible, though, try to process that pain, let go of the attachment, but then process that pain before it does anything. Mm-hmm. Because even if it is correct to go into the light, like you say, it will just, bam, start over and it will carry that pain. It won't have resolved it. So maybe get some free time to, because the ancient, one thing the ancient Egyptians were very cognizant of is that they said that, especially if you've been working with the mysteries, if you have a cultivated being, then the worst thing you can do is what the Hindus do, to burn. Burning was for the mass, mindless masses, because if you have never contemplated life and death, and you know, you're just an a useless mouth breather, as the elites call us, then you know, a short bum reset will save you a lot of fear and pain in the limbo state. But anyone who were what the ancient Greeks called philosophers, which obviously doesn't mean to, you know, today it's been degenerated to mean who thought what when. Mm-hmm. But like what we are doing here is to spend as much time in them, because they had tasks. They were working, initiations were death training, basically, same as what shamans do. So they wanted to be buried. In fact, they wanted mummification. They wanted that process to be slowed down as much as possible so that they could process the tasks, the spiritual tasks in between, before they were ready to move on. This would accelerate their refinement, and it would limit the number of reincarnations made. Okay. So all initiates, for example, in the Western tradition at least, had to be buried. That was the natural process. You need some time. You know, Tibetan monks, they 3 days, I think it is, before the, you know, to death help. So these are very interesting possibilities that I don't think most people think of, but you allow people to think of when you raise these questions.
Yeah, it's I did a lot of thinking of myself about mummification when I wrote my ancient Egyptian books and was asking very detailed questions of, I mean, obviously it became, eventually it became just another money-making chore for the priestly elite, but it came from obviously a very detailed understanding of something, and I asked a lot of questions of what would the reason for that actually be. And I agree with you, it has to do with the reincarnation cycle.
Let's leave it at that, because we can't give all the answers, and we can not even ask
we
all
cannot.
The, right? We can't, and better than answers are the right questions, but we have to limit those two.
Oh, wow.
Anyway, I think this is a good place for a break.
Okay.
Okay, so then we take five and see you in part three.
Perfect.
All of our files are free and will remain free. If you like the show, you can show support by donating $1 to help with expenses. Just use the PayPal link on our webpage. Thanks.